Accession number 13253, Jim Forrest, Reel 3.
Reel 3. So we're now looking at the your involvement with the anti-Vietnam War, aren't we?
That's right.
Jim? Yes.
Although I don't think we realized at the beginning of the Catholic Peace Fellowship that that would be our big work for years. The Vietnam War was still in its very early stages for Americans. Of course, the French had been there long since and left. We were thinking rather that there just needed to be a Catholic peace movement, something that, unlike the Catholic Worker, could concentrate on this issue of what does it mean to be a Catholic and to have and to respond to the to being in a very militaristic society. This was, whether the Vietnam War existed or not was an additional question. I had gone with an FOR group during my summer holiday on a scholarship that had been provided to Europe, along with John Heidbrink, the church work secretary of the FOR, Jim Douglas, who was a theologian then doing his doctoral studies in Rome, Dan Berrigan, a Jesuit priest, poet, who wasn't yet famous, something like the Bruce Kent, you could say, in America, but quite different character, but still the priest who, if any priest in the peace movement's name be known in America, would be Dan Berrigan, I suppose. Catholic laywoman from Chicago. There were a number of Catholics. There was another Jesuit priest with us. A group of about 15 or 20 people, Catholics and Protestants, going to Paris, Rome, Basel, where we visited Karl Barth, Prague, for the Christian Peace Conference meeting. And then the rest of the group went on to Moscow. I didn't. I flew to London and because I wanted to visit the people involved with the Pax Society here. And then I flew back to America. I also met Anton Wallach Clifford, incidentally, when I was here, who founded the Simon community. There was just a new group then, and very similar to the Catholic Worker, and I wanted to visit that. So these things brought me to London. And to visit Peace News. I wanted to have personal contact with the editors of Peace News, which in that time was a very impressive publication. So while in Prague, I can remember, particularly in Prague, that we had some discussions, Dan Berrigan, Jim Douglas, Hermine Evans, this Catholic laywoman from Chicago, about founding a Catholic Peace Fellowship, that we decided we would go ahead, we would not going to be bogged down by people who are afraid of contact with Protestants. That was ridiculous. And by the end of the year, we had actually started the Catholic Peace Fellowship. I was still working for this newspaper, but I gave notice. Dan Berrigan and Thomas Merton and several other people had agreed to be sponsors of the group, and Dan particularly was willing to try to raise money for it and was very good at doing that. Hermine Evans had quite a lot of money, and she was willing to put some of that into it. It seemed to me would be possible to make my living, modest living, being secretary to this little group and try to make it into something. I think the 1st of January, 65, I started my work in an office that we rented for $25 a month from the War Resisters League in Manhattan, in the lower, way down in the Lower East Side, down where my ancestors would have lived when New Amsterdam was there instead of New York, on streets that still have Dutch names, you know. Bleecker Street, in our case. Bleecker, was it? Yeah. Five. Beekman, it was Beekman. Oh, of course, the Dutch would say Beekman. Well, there we were, down there. First just myself, later Tom Cornell. Eventually we had a Catholic priest on the staff, an Australian, Father Elias, Lyle Young, L-Y-L-E, Young. What we hadn't anticipated was that, practically speaking, the Vietnam War was going to be our total work, because by 1965 the war was getting underway in a very massive way. And what we saw our work being was to let Catholics know that they didn't have to fight in this war. That even if they weren't pacifists, most of us who started this were, but if they simply looked at it from the point of view of the conditions of a just war, this did not qualify. And we did everything we could, and I think we did a rather remarkably good job of it, given our very small resources, to build the organization into something that was able to communicate with a large part of the Catholic community in America. I wrote a booklet called Catholics and Conscientious Objection, which miraculously, it seemed to me miraculously, got the imprimatur, that's the certification of the Archdiocese of New York, that it was doctrinally okay. This was, I don't remember how many copies we printed of that, hundreds of thousands in the course of the Vietnam War. It's still in print. It's been revised once since John Paul II became Pope. I wrote a new edition of it. The largest group of conscientious objectors to the war in Vietnam in America were Catholics. And I'm sure that wouldn't have been the case if it hadn't been for the existence of the Catholic Peace Fellowship. We were counseling on some weeks as many as 50 Catholic conscientious objectors, in person or by mail or by telephone. I was traveling all over the United States giving talks in high schools, Catholic high schools, seminaries, colleges. It was just day and night work for a long, long time.
Well, what exactly was your argument about the Vietnam War? You mentioned the concept of the just war, of course.
Yes. Well, I think, of course, that for us, the most driving thing wasn't really the just war. It was that it wouldn't have to say. We were very clear about it. We were pacifists. You could say that in the sense that there was an evangelistic or evangelical, that would be a more correct word, dimension to what we were doing. Because really, basically, what that would mean is we're talking about what it means to follow Jesus. We're talking about a person who, in his life, healed many and killed no one. And that never raised a weapon in his own defense. And when Peter raised his sword to defend him, was told to put it away. And the last healing miracle Jesus performed was on one of those arresting him. You see, I don't think people think about now or then this side of Jesus very much. And it's so clear, but it's all over the Gospels. So a lot of what we're saying wasn't just war stuff at all. It was just, what does it mean to follow Jesus? And is it for nothing that the incarnation happened when the Jewish people were being occupied, controlled, dominated by Rome? He's born into an occupied country and all this sort of thing. But then, of course, we were well prepared and quite willing to discuss the just war theory because that was the principal point of view that was taken by the Catholic Church for centuries, that under certain circumstances it's justifiable to participate in a war if it's declared by just authority, if just means are used, if there's a reasonable hope of it being a successful effort, if the lives of non-combatants are protected, and various other conditions, each of which... is crucial, and all together must be answered in the affirmative if the war is to be considered just. Simple. So we could say, well, you may not agree with our point of view about Jesus, but then if you're a Catholic, then at the very least you have to take seriously the just war doctrine, and you have to apply these questions to the situation and say, does in fact this war qualify? And I don't think it takes anybody with a PhD in the doctrines of St. Thomas Aquinas to come up with the answer. We were using methods of war, as indeed one almost invariably does use in war for a long, long time now, that are bound to kill far, far more non-combatants than combatants. The people most likely to survive war in the modern world are the combatants. They are the best equipped to survive. The ones who will not survive are the ordinary people. They are not equipped. They have no place to go. They have no idea of what to do. There's nobody trying to save their lives, really. They're just sitting ducks. And statistics has never been my field, but I would be surprised if it was less than 90% of the casualties in Vietnam were civilian casualties. You know. So And of course, one only had to turn on the television set to see the pictures of the destruction of villages, American soldiers taking their Zippo lighters out of their pockets and lighting thatched roofs on fire. Horrible scenes. So, so difficult to bear. And I think that to this day, it's, you can't look at these pictures and not feel horrified, shocked. And to see American kids being sent to Vietnam, and very few of them wanting to go, being drafted. There weren't long lines at the recruiting office of people who were eager to go to Vietnam and kill somebody. If without the draft, there would have been no possible, there wouldn't have been an army to fight the war. And there were groups, and we were one of them, who were trying to get the information across to Americans in general, but in our case, we were focusing even more on young people, saying, you do not have to fight in this war. You should ask yourself whether it is the right thing to do. And if you decide that for one reason or another it is not the correct thing to do, you have a right not to fight in this war, and we will stand behind you, and the church will stand behind you, the bishops will stand behind you, your pastor should stand behind you. If he didn't, he's not fulfilling his role. He should support you in your exercise of conscience. Even if it was a Catholic doctrine, is that even if your conscience is not properly formed, you still are obliged to follow it. But in this case, we could make the most rational argument in the world that far from having a poorly formed conscience, your conscience was very carefully formed by the teachings of the Church and by the Gospel. So I'm happy to say that there were a large number of Catholics who became conscientious objectors, and we were able to help quite a few of them. And I think that although this is not an active form of protest, simply the large numbers of American kids who chose to be conscientious objectors was a very important message to the...
What were their options, you know, having decided to be a conscientious objector?
Two, essentially. One would be to do alternative service, which would be the typical, most common form, and then the alternative would be to refuse to do anything at all, and then to go to prison as a draft resister. We supported all these types of choices. We said, whatever you feel obliged to do, we will support you. Although I'm trying to remember my views at the time. Now I would very strongly support alternative service. I think at the time it was probably divided thoughts. There were always great arguments raging within the pacifist movement about how, what stands to take, how much to resist, and so forth and so forth. And I was always thinking, there, everybody seems to be right here.
You know, did you have any problems with the authorities because of the very strong support you were given?
I don't think so. It's to the credit of the United States that even in wartime, at least since the Second World War, there has been a reasonable degree of tolerance of dissent. It's one of the good things about the United States that one might not see in every country, certainly wouldn't see it. We know for sure this is an exceptional quality. We were not, of course, there was FBI surveillance, naturally. We knew that. I took it rather for granted. I'd grown up with the FBI. There's nothing new to me. there were people who considered us traitors. I can remember receiving some death threats from time to time. Didn't take them very seriously. It made me feel I must be doing something right. And I think I've always held on to life with a not too tight a grasp. I'm sure that God will let me live as long as I'm supposed to, and when that's not, when God has other things in mind, that will be that. I haven't been too possessive about life. It's always amazed me that I've lived as long as I have, every year of the way. So I wasn't too worried about that.
Did you find that there was class was a factor in the young people you were helping?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, the people who were conscientious objectors were almost every, in every case, people from middle class, upper middle class, or wealthy backgrounds. And the people who fought the war were the same people who went to prison, mostly. Of course, there were a far higher percentage of people who had education and family background of one sort or another in the armed forces than there are in the prisons. But it would say in the prisons you might have 90 or 95% or 97% who would be poor, where in the armed forces it would probably be more like half, maybe, would come from fairly poor background. And this, for certainly people who came from the black or Puerto Rican communities, for example, this would be, for many of them, a step up in life, to get into the military, get an education, all kinds of opportunities that you never would have had before, you see. And if you did well in the military, there were, again, almost infinite possibilities for you. If you could survive in wartime, of course, there's that question. I can't imagine any factors more powerful than economic factors for a lot of people who went into the armed services. Voluntarily, I'm talking about. And the draft, well, the more privileged your background, the more likely you were to find a way out. Dan Quayle, the last vice president of the United States, a perfect example of that. His family connections, he was able to go into the National Guard. Then he became, later on, as militaristic as they come. I have no respect for that. You know, if you've managed to find some place at the dessert table while everybody else is on the battlefield, and then later on you become the greatest militarist of all time, I have no respect for that. Very few people I can imagine not liking in principle, but he would be on that short list.
You're from Bill Clinton as well, I suppose.
Clinton was, as I understand it, I have never followed his biography closely enough to say very much about it. Openly opposed the war, you see. He didn't look for the soft option. He didn't try to get into the National Guard. He was—he didn't believe the war was right, and he said so, and he demonstrated against it. And I say, fine. I don't know if he's probably still... He may have some second thoughts about his position at that time. I don't know. But at least I don't feel that there was anything... He's never disowned that period of his life. He was here in England, studying at Oxford, as I recall. Took part in some peace group there. This was held against him during the election, but I never heard on Dutch television anything that I thought was did him badly about that.
Although he never sort of defended that position, did he?
No, because I think when you run to be president of the United States, you really want to... it's not so much disown your past as to make it clear to people that you plan to represent everybody as much as possible, and that his big message was to try to bring people together and not to divide them and so forth. Whether he can do that or not, time will tell. But I didn't feel he was... I wasn't annoyed by things that he said on that score. Whereas I've heard Quayle speak. I've been president. I've met Quayle. I've been in conferences where he... A conference in The Hague where he spoke to people from the NATO alliance. And I must say I was appalled, you see. Speaking out with this kind of phony American salesmanship methods that I find so distasteful about how we need to continue nuclear testing. Patting his heart as he's talking about this. And I remember going home, he was not Vice President of the United States at the time, and saying there was an American senator at this conference who looked to me like he wasn't old enough to get a beer without showing his driver's license, talking about how wonderful nuclear testing is. I was appalled. And then when he was chosen to be vice president,
it was very interesting, you know, and moving when you were talking about the media. Do you think the media was a very important sort of arm to what you were doing, in as much that the... Am I right in thinking that the war was covered?
See, I think it was unusual in that normally... for either voluntary or in a voluntary or involuntary way, the media is used by the government for its own political ends. This is the usual thing. During the 60s, the media in the United States broke ranks. It wasn't an anti-war movement, absolutely not. But it simply felt it had to do its job, which was to objectively report what was happening there, to show people the truth about it, and rather than what the government wanted them to know. This is most unusual. I think it would be a very interesting study indeed to take a look at the history of war and what was the public was allowed to know about it at the time, and to contrast the reality with the reports. There would be few instances that would be anything like what happened in the Vietnam War, where people, of course, we even had the technology at our disposal to know instantly, practically speaking, what was going on. So Americans saw the reality of war much more clearly than most people get to see war while it's being fought.
Can you think of any particular examples?
Well, the most famous example is the My Lai massacre. The Lieutenant Calley ordered his men to machine gun to death women and children and any other people who happened to be in the village. And thanks to the courage of the editors of Life magazine, and more, of course, the courage of the people who made it known to the journalists in the first place. But ultimately, one has to say it took courage for Life to publish these photographs and these interviews and to let this war crime become known to the American people. But this, of course, was just one of countless examples of innocent people being killed. It was simply the cold-bloodedness of the thing and the fact that defenseless people were simply being lined up and shot dead in a Nazi-style execution that absolutely shocked people. And, of course, Calley, I think, his punishment for all this murder was very, very light indeed. He was allowed to live in a comfortable apartment on a military base in America. Now today, I think he's selling cars or insurance or I forget what. I heard recently some cushy job someplace and making a decent living and probably a respected member of the community. Well, I'm sorry for him. I'm reading at the moment Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. And as you know, it's a story about a young man who commits murder coming to realize that his only hope is a life of penance after that. Otherwise, he's lost. Absolutely.
Yes, you know, thinking of examples like that, you know, and what the troops in Vietnam did,
yes,
and some of them what they had to endure and see. Did you have anything to do with the veterans, you know, the young men coming back from?
I'm sad to say I didn't have very much to do with that. It was mostly done by the veterans themselves. I knew some people who'd been in the war and come out of it, and their testimony had great influence, particularly one young Mormon that I happened to meet who had come out of a military mental hospital, having had a complete breakdown in the war, and told me what had happened to him during his brief period in service. I'm sure if I were to attempt to tell you what he told you, I'd spend a great deal of time crying. But we know that when people have been in combat, they often do things which they cannot bear to talk about afterward, and that we have in this, in every country where there are people who have fought in wars, we're surrounded by them all the time, people who have not been able to tell what happened to them, and who can never quite get over the horror of the thing. And
when they returned, you know, damaged young men like your Mormon you've explained,
yes,
was it anything done for these people by, you know, the American government? Were they given the
Well, the government can't possibly tell them the one thing. Dostoevsky is right about this. The only thing you can do after you've done something horrible is to spend your life essentially in a penitential way, trying to do things to take care of life and to know that this blood will never quite wash off. You know, it's only in the mercy of God that it will wash off to some extent. And finally, of course, it will wash off completely in the mercy of God. But we won't know that in this life.
Do you think that war affected America, the Vietnam War, you know, the society?
Oh, dear heavens, yes. Oh, it's still an undigested thing, you see. I mean, I think we have never, ever been sorry for anything we did. Not this war, not any other war that we were part of. The Native Americans who were killed by the tens of thousands, millions perhaps. The slaves who were killed in enormous numbers, either overtly just simply killed because they'd stepped out of line, or killed because they had were inconvenient, or killed because they didn't have the shelter that they needed, or the medical care, or they died of neglect, and so forth and so forth. It's so rare to see, but most rare in America because of the particular culture we have, to even think about penance. The Pope was in Sicily yesterday. I was quite struck to see the account in the Guardian this morning. He spoke extemporaneously on several occasions about the Mafia, and at one point he simply said, repent. Now this is the most unpolitic word. We think we're talking to some kind of religious lunatic if somebody starts talking about repentance. But I honestly think it's the word we most desperately need of. Until we repent, I think we're trapped to repeat. Until we realize we've committed an awful sin and that the only thing we can do is to acknowledge it, beg forgiveness, try to repair what harm we can repair at this time. I mean, we can't bring the dead back to life. We can't. There's many things that are irreversible, but nonetheless, there's some things that we can do. And to spend the rest of our lives, one way or another, trying to point ourselves in a different direction. Influences on me, I should mention, beginning during the Vietnam War and up to this day, was the friendship that developed with this Vietnamese Buddhist monk, Thich Nhat Hanh. Thichnhat Hanh. Vietnamese Zen master, poet of great renown, scholar, Sanskrit expert, very knowledgeable in ancient Chinese, most remarkable, astounding man. Professor at Van Han University in Saigon, V-A-N-H-A-N-H, Van Han University, who met an FOR delegation who came to Vietnam, to Saigon, and deeply impressed the General Secretary of the American FOR, Executive Secretary, it's called, Al Hassler, H-A-S-S-L-E-R. Al Hassler invited him to come to the United States, and he did come. He was invited by Cornell University, and the State Department gave him a visa. And he, after fulfilling his obligations at Cornell, proceeded to meet with a variety of people. It would be very interesting at some point to do some research on the significance of these trips. He, for example, had a long meeting in Washington with Secretary of Defense McNamara that was arranged by the FOR, and a meeting which was to have... It was remarkable that he was willing to meet with him at all. I think the meeting was scheduled as a 15 or 20-minute meeting. It lasted 2 or 3 hours. He was somebody who really made people listen. He spoke with simplicity, absolute honesty, a reserve, and communicated a kind of spiritual depth which Americans rarely encounter. He didn't speak with contempt to Americans. He didn't. He wasn't self-righteous. He wasn't accusing. And when I had the good fortune to be invited to accompany him on some of his travels, it was, of course, a major event in my life. I felt, I think this is not an overstatement, like I had come from a very primitive society. It was clearer to me in his company than it had ever been before that I lived in a kind of Stone Age. And that he came from a real culture, that what we had in America wasn't yet a culture.